Couple of questions I have to maybe get things going. I want to go back to the Jeff, please. I want to go back to the question of black hole spin, and Heino gave us evidence that either all the spins are the same or they're not important for the jet power. And I didn't quite follow the argument why they shouldn't be nearly all the same, especially after Jeff's talk, where it looked like for the supermassive black holes, they maybe were nearly all the same. And the other thought is that maybe there's a selection effect here anyway, and that the Heino was looking at high luminosity quasars, which maybe the low luminosity, the low spin objects are the FR1 radio sources. So there may be a selection effect there. So
now, if you look at one and FR2 becomes an FR1, that's of course below a certain power. FR2s turn into FR1s. But the correlation I showed extended well above the break where FR2s turn into FR1s. I mean, the reason why FR2s turn into FR1s is because the power is too low. They don't really get out of the galaxy. And then, you know, they are peeled off, essentially, and you never get as a clean beam out into intergalactic medium where a hotspot ends. So there was, you know, two orders of magnitude above, from 10 to 46 ergs per second, where FR2s turn on, to 10 to 48 ergs per second in optical power, where you have all FR2s can exist, yet they decide to still follow the optical radio correlation. And if you would have sort of a second parameter spin, which gives you a squared effect, right, and you change the spin by a factor of 3, you have allow spins from 0.3 to 0.9, which is certainly a reasonable number, you would get a factor 10 in that range. And you actually only allowed sort of a 0.1 change in the spin range, you know, if you look at the scatter, right? If the additional scatter that can come allows you sort of, you know, 0.1 dex.
But so few supermassive black hole spins have been measured. Do we know that there are any as low as 0.3? Maybe Jeff can.
Well, I think that there's large observational selection, as I was trying to say today, on the spins that have been measured by the iron line method, that these broad iron lines are more easily detected and more easily analyzed. And as I showed in that table, most of the spins that have been measured are really quite extreme, and only a few were relatively low. And so I don't think that it's a very representative, and it's just one class of mostly these Seyfert galaxies. So it's to draw broad conclusions from that and to, you know, work out scenarios for how spins and supermassive black holes form, how they're created by mergers or by all the models that Bonteri and others have made and so forth. I just don't think the data are good enough, and I think it'll be interesting to the extent possible to get spins for these black holes from other means, for example, from the Event Horizon Telescope, to the extent that perhaps you can get a population of a dozen spin measurements, spin estimates over time. It would be quite a different selection of objects. And so I'm concerned about the observational bias.
And indeed, I mean, you made a very thoughtful comment in that we look at very different populations, not only in terms of the galaxies, right? So we're looking here at the elliptical. These are typically very massive elliptical galaxies. They probably have undergone a lot of mergers, so they will have sort of undergone a very different evolution than some of the Seyfert galaxies you've been discussing. So that, you know, that's difficult to make a conclusion. And then you compare it to the X-ray binaries, and indeed, as you said, and this is a very, very valid comment, this was, you know, when they're really in outburst, and it may well be that you see different types of jets or different processes being more strong, when you're in the outburst phase compared to when you're really in the steady continuous outflow phase that we see in these FR2s and other sources. So, it's not necessarily a really head-on collision. It's certainly something to keep in mind and explore further, I would say. It doesn't rhyme completely yet. That's what I would say. Yes, for sure. But of course, as you know, around 0.99, you have a rather strong evolution sort of the spin effect. So if you go from 0.99 to 0.95 and 0.9, that already makes a big effect. So if you don't really can allow a big range in spins. But of course, that is possible. Then you still have to think about the low luminosity AGN, where the radio X-ray or radio optical, what I showed was actually bolometric luminosity. Versus radio, which I think hadn't been done before. So it really captures the entire energy output from the AGN compared to the radio emission. And then if you mass correct, it's a sort of nice correlation. And you could get around that and so I'd say, okay, that tight correlation is because actually all the bolometric luminosity is coming from the jet and not the accretion disk. Now that is a contentious issue at the moment, but that is certainly another way out. Around this.
I think there was a question up there, Marta.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to comment on this. Since we have done some statistical predictions for distribution of black hole spins in galaxies of different types. So there are some models, there is some variety of models, but some of them predict that the range of black hole spins is rather small. Either most black holes have very low spins or most black holes have very high spins. And I would be very curious to see if any of these models actually match or at least agree with the distribution that you find, which is tight as well.
What you all can say it's narrow to within 0.1 dex, right? So that's
So there are models out there that you may be comparing with the observations. So it would be interesting to see if while we wait for measurements of spins in a more reliable and unbiased sample, we already have means to compare what we observe with the theoretical expectations.
It's of course chicken and egg problem, and that is we don't know yet. We don't know neither the spin nor whether the spin is really goes as a squared in those jets, and one of the two. We have to constrain. Once we know how jets, what the spin effect is on jets, and we are certain how that translates into radiation, we could certainly, I think, measure the spins statistically on large samples with these methods and compare it to the spin measurements. But at the moment we have this uncertainty. Now, which of the two effects? Is
Jonathan.
Spins were very small. So for example, the jet power doesn't have to go like the Lambert's Nyack. It could be driven purely by magnetic reconnection, like I was mentioning. And in that case, you don't need spin at all. You just need a magnetic reservoir. And it's just flipping back and forth, and that's what's producing the kind of jets and producing the hot components, which we're observing, actually. So it kind of nicely also gets you the observed component. Is there any contradiction with that? Obviously, the X-ray binary spins may be a contradiction, although maybe there are ways to get around that. Do we need spin at all for anything? If we have chaotic accretion for the evolution of black holes, everything is low spin. Can we avoid that? Or?
Well, the model that the Charles and Monica were making, of course, had 0.9C spin, and that worked nicely. Don't think we haven't done that for lower spins. That's sort of the next thing to do. Well, one thing you could sort of picture is, okay, you have this inner spine, which may be sort of Blanford's Nyack. And then the sheath, clearly the sheath in these models goes linear with accretion rate, right? Because it just depends on the number of particles that flow in, you know, directly translate the number of particles that flow out. It's just the standard scaling. So maybe that sheath taps also a little bit into the magnetic power. It also has to do with the wind, which is more Blanford-Payne-like, right? So maybe that sheath has a different scaling than just pure Blanford's knife.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe even Blanford's knife, it was not even relevant, let's say.
It may also work if the spine is not that strong. You may maybe get less collimated jet. I mean, the Seyfert galaxies, for example, it's interesting. They may be in this high state. They still have some outflows, but which clearly are less powerful. So maybe something is happening there.
I think Svetlana would like to...
Yeah, I have also a question for Feina. I would like to ask, if spin is included in the luminosity function. Really, luminosity function which you use is already has dependence on the spin. Then it is possible that you really don't need the same spin to have this tight connection.
The constraint will be less strong. But what I was suggesting was that we know luminosity should depend on spin, right?
Yeah,
because so higher spin, you get deeper in the gravitational potential,
which
means you get factor six more or so, compared to Schwarzschild, factor six more radiation. If you had a similar type of scaling for the jet power, some modest, the jet power to accretion disk luminosity would be fairly constant. So that would work. If you would then have or it's not exactly the same, but sort of similar order, and then you have a small range of spin, then probably that would also work. So I think there's probably going to be some middle ground. Are we making some extreme,
so
It
seems to me it's possible that you have a spin in your luminosity.
I mean, definitely some spin dependence will be there. I mean, that would be very surprising if that wouldn't go there.
Sure.
Yeah, so we're talking very generally about jets. But I'd like to ask, and pardon me if you've already discussed this, but when we look down at the few Schwarzschild radius scale, right, which we're going to have access to in fairly short order, especially when AMA comes online and South Pole comes online, well, not for M87, but Greenland in the fullness of time, what are we looking at there? Because Heino talked about the black hole setting the scale, but we also heard from Jeff about the ISCO setting the scale in the thin disk case, and we don't think that's the case for M87. We think it's a kind of a puffy, Rioff kind of disk. But are there some strong GR signatures that we can hang our hat on as observers when we start to make these very fine scale observations? Because I sense a concordance or discussion about entire jets, but when we look at M87 parochially, what should we be thinking that we're seeing? And is there any way we can tease out through either polarization on small scales or total flux on small scales, some signature there?
I'd like to add to that from both yesterday and today, the GMHD models don't naturally, as far as I can see, give us the particle acceleration. And that's sort of painted onto the models. And I'm not sure where that occurs. And there are a couple of posters out there from the BU group, Alan Marsher and Svetlana, where the jet lights up at a strong shock where the non-thermal particle acceleration happens, which is quite far from the black hole. And the jet is pretty much quiet in synchrotron radiation before that. And that raises the possibility that the EHT, there may not be much jet to see with the EHT because it's further out. I don't know if the comments on that.
I guess my comments, observers here from M87 should address this, but my understanding is if you look at the VOBI images, you see the jet going all the way down. Of course, you have this knot A, right, in M87 lightening up at some point. But clearly there's jet emission all the way down to a few short-shot radii. I mean, you see the core shift that you've shown. So that's definitely happening.
The other thing is, in the case of M87, it's a very good point. I think it's pretty clear from some images that I saw from Craig Walker that the counterjet has pretty convincingly been detected now. So there's almost no place for the black hole to hide at this point. And the counterjet, from what Craig has told me, matches the kinds of faintness that one would expect for a jet that's just starting to accelerate, but is pointing away in roughly the canonical viewing angle of like 15 degrees or something like that. So I think the black hole, the core, if it's not at the black hole, can't be too far away. Right. Can I ask one question of Jeff? Jeff, so I was watching your really amazing stuff with the spins and the continuum fitting method. I assume you use GR to ray trace from the accretion disk up. But don't you have to make some assumptions also about the extent of the disk far out? Because then you wouldn't get the stuff lensed from underneath the disk coming towards you. It would wind up hitting the near side of the disk if it extends too far, right?
So some of the radiation, you know, does strike the disk, and it's included in our model as heating the disk at that point. But, you know, indeed, all the ray tracing is done, and all the GR effects are taken into account. It's really a very simple thin disk Novikov-Thorne model, and all the ray tracing and everything is there. Yeah, I would like to just add on these jets that the jets that we observe, the ones that produce this correlation with spin, and the very strong effect as you go from spin 0 to spin 0.95 or something, meaning a factor of 300, 500 in jet power, that these are particular, the only measurement we can make is when these systems go to Eddington, because that's the only time we know their mass accretion rate, it's Eddington. And so we're very restricted to just this one class of ballistic jets that episodically occur in these X-ray binaries at a given time. And right now we have a sample of 5, not 500 or whatever. So this is, you know, preliminary evidence, but we feel it's strong evidence that at least in this one class of jets, that spin is important.
Jonathan?
You said that you know the mass accretion rate because it's approached Eddington, but I guess from the latest simulations, including what Ramesh has been doing, there's no really limit on the mass accretion rate. Maybe the luminosity that you get out can be limited to roughly Eddington or something like that, but there's no limit on the inflow rate. So would that affect the results by using those observations? You may not be able to get the exact mass accretion rate, so you may not be able to estimate the efficiency or something like that?
So as for the efficiency and for the actual mass accretion rate, which as you say can go very, very high, well above Eddington, from an observer's point of view, I'm simply talking about we know the mass, we know the distance, we know all about the systems, and we're talking about the luminosity reaching Eddington. So that's what I mean when I say Eddington limited accretion. We don't actually know what the mass accretion rate into the black hole is, and we don't need to know it, hopefully.
Sarah?
So this is actually getting back to your question, John, about the particle acceleration, or this is a question about this, but do we actually know where M87's jets become optically thin, or do we have a spectral measurement down with the VLBI that we know there's a power law?
I think still that 230 is optically thick the core. But the question is really we need to the figure out jet is not coming from the ergosphere. The jet ejection point the offset. That means I think the counter jet still the subluminal is something that important physics to be had to backlight by the gravitational lensing. That means that not only the jet but also counter jet is important to derive the physics. The question is the ARMA, maybe the higher frequency rather than 300, they have some feature to turn on that optical thing.
Yeah,
that means the question is, it's really infinite frequency is the places. Maybe the MH7 cases, they have some limitation applied to the Brownlow-Corning model. It's clearly we can test it rather than the different from the blazar jet.
I mean, I'm asking a simpler question, actually, which is, are we convinced that there are particles being accelerated? Because we know with Sagittarius Star, we can fit the emission with, as Monica was showing, just a mainly thermal distribution. So do we actually know that those particles lighting up the jet near the core are non-thermal?
Yes.
That's my question.
Robert?
I'll try and at least make a vague answer to that question. I mean, we know that there is non-thermal emission, which is very plausibly synchrotron going up even into the X-rays, but we don't know, obviously, how small this is because we don't have a high-resolution telescope operating at those frequencies. I mean, to HST resolution, we know that there is non-thermal emission that you can trace all of the way up from the radio through the ultraviolet from the core region, but that's not a very good size scale limit. Yeah, no, I mean, we know this particle acceleration in a somewhat larger volume, but the question is, where does that cut in? That's a good question. Can I take the advantage of clutching the microphone? I mean, again, a slightly provocative question. I mean, we've been talking about the relative importance of accretion disks and jets on the small scales. And traditionally, in low luminosity AGN, this is addressed by fitting spectral energy distributions. And I have always found it extremely unconvincing that there was any emission from the accretion disk at all in those spectral energy distributions, except in Sagittarius A star. So I'd like to ask, what is the evidence for any detectable emission from the accretion disk in M87? And we can open bracket, there are absorption and Faraday rotation tracers which might be able to see ionized gas on those scales much more sensitively, but can we see any emission that we can definitively attribute to the accretion disk in M87?
Can any of you take that?
Not as far as I know.
I'm thinking that most of the emission is coming from the jet, so then as I mentioned, the only possibilities are the probing with a Faraday rotation. That is my opinion.
No, I agree. I mean, this is not a. Maybe it's a provocative statement, but I mean, Sarah and I actually, 10 years ago, we had this paper on that X-ray binaries in low Hartstedt, actually all the emission would be from the jet and not from the accretion disk. Of course, we've been beaten up on this all the time, but it may still be true, at least in some sources, I think. And it may very well be for this low luminosity AGN. So maybe most of the emission is actually, certainly in M87. I mean, M87 is also blazar, right? That's, of course, a bit an oddball, right? Because it's pointing towards us. I think the SED you can almost completely fit with just jet-only emission. But then if you go to sort of more low luminosity AGN where the jet is more from the side, you can still argue that X-ray emission is coming not from the jet but from the accretion disk, that there is still some optical non-thermal emission from the accretion disk. I think it's a completely unresolved issue. Right?
Anybody else want to weigh in on that or anything else? Jonathan.
I just had a question for Monica regarding the simulations and the emission. It looked like from the emission that things would be either very time variable, and I don't know if you looked at the time variations.
No.
Maybe that's inconsistent with observations.
I haven't looked at the time variability. I don't think it makes sense at this point because this electron distribution function could be, also a function of time. So. It's probably too much effort, and we can learn nothing.
So related to that, it's also related to what Elliot was talking about yesterday, trying to light up the edge of the jet. And it looked like in your movies that there's a lot of small chunks of stuff. And I was wondering whether you could comment on whether those are the things dominating the emission, or whether there's a more diffuse, extended kind of object or region, which is what's dominating the emission. I would be worried about those chunks being more numerical artifacts.
So those chunks are a little bit artificial here because this is the way that we define the jet. We just use some Bernoulli parameter for that. So this may be not like strictly like physical. So they are a little bit artificial, I think.
Those dominate the emission or not? Those little chunks?
Yes, yes. I mean, those red spots that you saw on jets. So, yes. This is where most of the emission comes from. I think the next step for this kind of simulation, if somebody wants to continue this, is to basically do the polarized transfer and see what kind of polarization features would be visible in those two regimes where you have bright jet and cool disk and the opposite, hot disk and cool jet. I think that there could be a significant difference between those two models, and maybe that's the way to proceed.
Do we have any more questions for the panel? In which case, let's thank them and let's break a little bit early for lunch.